From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. It's a big kick to have my next guest on the show. Fred Iwanek has been a actor for a long time. If you're having a bad day, come home, turn on Corner Gas, turn on Dan for Mayor, turn on anything this gentleman's been in, and you're going to walk away feeling pretty good. We're all happy here in Saskatchewan that Corner Gas is coming back for a movie, and I thought, what better guy besides Brent to come on the show and talk. And I know Brent's busy. He's probably hanging out with Lindsay Lohan or somebody tonight.
He's a big guy.
Yeah, I know. I've had Brent on the show before, and it's always great to have someone from Corner Gas on. Fred, welcome to Saskatchewan.
Thanks a lot. It's good. I'm not back yet, but I'm getting excited. I can't wait to be back there.
Fred, you've never left Saskatchewan. Like I say, anytime we turn on and see Hank, it's just part of the community. And I'm going to ask you this question. What about Hank? Are you worried about playing Hank too much, or is this a role that you can keep going on and going on and going on with?
Well, no, I mean, I would play him. I'd play him until they, you know, kicked me out of the party. Like, I'd keep going as long as they let me. But so I don't care. But, you know, I don't think so. I mean, if there was a character that I was, let's say, cursed to play for eternity, I'd be pretty happy if it was Hank. He's a lot of fun.
You know, and I'm not blowing smoke when I say that Corner Gas, Dan for Mayor, the work that you've done, Brent, and all the others, it's just good old-fashioned entertainment. A lot of crap on TV these days, but you can sit down and watch these shows, and I can watch them over and over again, have a lousy day, and you can walk away feeling good. Is that part of the reason why you wanted to come back?
Well, it's definitely one of, there's a ton of reasons why I wanted to come back, but yeah, that's one thing I was always proud of about Corner Gas was, you know, like you say, there's so much of this other stuff on TV, and Corner Gas, I was always proud of the fact that the whole family could sit around and watch it. And, you know, the parents didn't have to worry about covering up or explaining to the kids, and there was some laughs for everybody. So that's definitely one of the reasons, and just being back in Saskatchewan and seeing all my old friends and getting to see the gang again, it's going to be a blast.
Fred Iwanek's here. He played Hank Yarbo on Corner Gas for many seasons, Dan on Dan for Mayor, and many other things. In fact, I was watching Monk the other day, and there's Fred on Monk. So you've been in the business a long time. Tell us a little bit. How long have you been around?
I took acting and stuff all through high school and stuff, but I didn't really expect I'd be able to make a living at it. Actually, I had a bunch of acting teachers tell me that I didn't stand the chance, so I was looking to be a truck driver or something, but I don't know how I ended up making jobs. But when I was about 30, I decided, I'm gonna give it a go, and that was about 12 years ago, so... I just told you how old I was, too. So I've been in it for that long, and it's been good. I've been really fortunate.
Forever youthful Fred Iwanek's here. He played Hank Yarbo on Corner Gas. Corner Gas, the movie, starts filming in June. It will be out around Christmas time. What about the ensemble? It must be great to be able to work with this group of people, have them all come back, and it'll be just like old times, like you'd never left.
Oh, yeah. No, when we got word, it was a while ago, too, and we had to keep our mouth shut, which was tough, believe me. But when we got word, it was probably about a month ago. It's one of the things I got really excited about was just to get to see everybody again. And, you know, when the show ended, we all kind of went our own ways, and you kind of keep tabs through social media and stuff, but, you know, don't really get to see anybody, so now we get to really get back at it. And, yeah, I'm pretty excited.
What about that? What about social media today? There's the Kickstarter program with the movie, and I encourage everybody to go to the link on the website, cornergasthemovie.com, and check it out, make a donation. And what about that? Big changes since you've left. TV is looked at a little different way now. This isn't going to be a regular series, but you got to know that after this, they're going to ask you, when's the next movie? When's the sequel? You know, how many times were they rescued on Gilligan's Island? I think three or four times.
So, that's right. Yeah.
So what about that?
Well, I mean, yeah, things have changed. I mean, I can remember, I can't remember exactly what season it was, but I remember when the first iPhone came out, and one guy, one of the crew guys on our set had it, and it was like the Holy Grail. Everybody was just, what is this amazing piece of technology? And now that's, you know, look what we're doing now with all the, like you say, social media, and doing it all through our phones. It's crazy. And you're right, it's changed the way people view media and TV and all that stuff. It's changing everything. It's crazy.
What about Brent Butt? I've had him on the show. Couldn't find a nicer gentleman, funny guy. What's he like to work with?
He's a big jerk, and he owes me $20. he's a class guy. Obviously, I mean, anybody that's met him will tell you that. And there's two people I've met in my life, Brent Butt and Mary Walsh, and they're two people that sometimes they just say things that are so funny and so smartly funny that you don't even laugh. You just kind of sit there in awe. It's like, how did you even come up with that? And he's a brilliant mind. He's very funny, and I'm glad he decided to do this movie.
One thing I talked about Brent with, and I'm going to talk to you about a little bit, is Canadian television, Canadian movies, and the glut of American programming with the 500-channel universe now, and you got a channel for everything. Canadian programming is, you know, it's there. Everybody's trying. What do you think of the state of Canadian programming today?
Well, I think it's a lot better than it was, that's for sure. I mean, there's been a lot of strong shows. I mean, when Corner Gas came out, it was a bit unheard of for a show to get 1 million viewers.
Right.
And now that kind of seems to be the standard for Canadian television, which is fantastic. And now you hear more and more stories of shows like, I know it's done now, Flashpoint, you know, and they're making sales down the States. Motive is co-pro with, U.S. networks. And so I think it is a bit better. It's definitely better, I think. I still don't think it's where it should be. I think they should be making more original Canadian content, but I mean, you know, that's just me being a whiny little Canadian actor probably.
Yeah, but there's a North American audience, Corner Gas seen all over 50-some countries, whatever it is. What does Hank sound like in Japanese?
I'm not even going to attempt it because I'll probably make somebody angry. But it's funny because I was just talking about that today. I was golfing with a friend of mine, and he was asking me about where it shows, and I said Germany, and he's like, "Wow, that must be crazy. Have you heard your dub voice in German?" I was like, "No, but man, that would be cool. I want to hear Hank in German."
Yeah, and is Jackass in German? I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't know either. I don't know what it would be. What would it be? Haldenpalden? I don't know.
Fred Wanix here. Corner Gas, the movie, starts filming in June. Look for it to be out in December, Christmas time. And you, as an actor, you're trying to keep busy. Lots of work. We've got a link to your website on the show notes. You do this now. The next project is going to come up. You get a phone call from whoever and all that sort of stuff. How do you pick the projects that you want to do?
Well, somebody says we want to hire you, and I go good, and I pick it. No, you know, it's a bit tougher. Like as high profile as Corner Gas was in Canada, I still have to kind of work, you know, audition and try out for different parts, and I'm trying to go for those bigger parts. So I'm going up against some pretty big American names and stuff. So it's a bit tricky. So. But, you know, I pick away at it, and I'm able to eat and pay the bill, so I'm doing all right.
One of the rarities in this world today with television is being on two series at the same time. You did that with Corner Gas and Robson Arms. How tough was that?
Well, it was a bit tricky. I was actually, and for one season, I was shooting a film, too, Young Triffy. So yeah. I was going back and forth from Saskatchewan back to BC and then flying out to Newfoundland. And sometimes you're kind of scrambling on the set and you got to turn to somebody who's like, what's my character's name? Hank. Okay, good. Thanks. it's like a whirlwind.
The state of governments and funding and all this sort of stuff, and I'm not going to get into that because there was lots of issues here in Saskatchewan.
Yeah.
But how important is it for, you know, obviously a film needs to be funded. And if there was ever something that helps tourism in Saskatchewan or has helped tourism, it's Corner Gas. How important is it for the people, the governments, the Kickstart programs to be involved with these projects?
Oh, I just if anybody in the film industry in Saskatchewan, and probably you don't even have to be in the film industry in Saskatchewan to realize what happens when the tax credit goes away.
Right.
It almost immediately you basically saw the end of the film industry in that province. And I know of a lot of people that have left the province for other places because they couldn't find work. And I know with this, unfortunately, with this production, as great as it is that we're going back, they're going to have to get most of their crew from other provinces. So there's your answer as to what happens when you're not competitive in that market.
Fred Wanix here, Corner Gas, the movie coming out soon. Your advice, young person wanting to get into acting, wanting to get into the business, so to speak. You've been around, like I say, I'm not trying to age you, a long time. I saw you on Monk here the other day. And what about that? What's your advice?
Well, if you're going to do it, make sure you love it. And don't make, but at the same time, don't make it your life. When I first got into it, my agent said to me, he said, okay, look, 95% of the money is made by 5% of the actors. So there's what you're kind of getting into. There's a ton of actors out there. So really make sure you love it, because you're going to get rejected a whole bunch for all various reasons. So as long as you love it, though, you can always do it. So.
You know, and we alluded to this a little bit at the start of the interview, that you're going to film your final scene and people are already going to be wondering when the sequel's coming out. And I know Brent has gone public saying he wants to do this one more time. And I have no inside say as far as what's going to happen, what the script's like, what's going on. But you look at some of the shows, the season or series finales, they come back, they do a movie, and then it's so tough to come back. They always say a sequel is the toughest thing to do. Are you concerned a little bit, or is this something that you're pretty confident about?
About this feature, like how people are going to perceive this, receive the feature, you mean?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I'm pretty confident. I'm very confident that the fans of Corner Gas are going to love the movie. I mean, one of my big concerns was how do you make a Corner Gas movie? Like, what is a Corner Gas movie? Is it just going to be a really long episode? And in that case, it's like, well, you don't really want to do that. You want to stay true to the show. You want people, and you want to stay true to your fans. But when I got the script, when we received it, I thought they did a great job of making a movie. It's a great movie, and it's in the Corner Gas world. So the fans are going to be really happy. And if we could manage to get not maybe people that are on fans of Corner Gas, they're going to enjoy it. It's a well-structured film. So.
Again, something you can watch and feel good about. Fred Wanix here for about another 7 minutes, if I can keep him that long.
Oh, yeah.
And we're having fun. We're talking about it. Going back in the business, I mentioned Monk and Tony Shalhoub and those type of actors that are out there. Who do you pattern yourself after, or are you just Fred?
I think I'm just Fred. I mean, I definitely don't pattern myself after him at all, but if I could choose a career, I would have chosen Robert De Niro's career.
Right.
But by no means, I don't want anybody to take that as I think I'm Robert De Niro. But that's sort of the career I would choose. But I think you get into trouble if you try to be other people. You just got to be yourself. And I approach characters that I get the way I see them, and either people like them or they don't. That's all. I can't really control anything else.
Eric Peterson is an example of the serious stuff. He's funny as hell. He can do whatever. And what about a serious role for Fred? Is that in the future? I know you've done some, but is there something coming up that we're going to see a scary or a mean Fred?
No, nothing on the horizon. I did a movie, an independent movie that will hit the festival circuit later this year. And it's more of a serious straight role, so it is a little different. And I'm definitely open to play whatever. Early on in my career, I was playing all different sorts of characters, and I really enjoy that. But I don't get too picky. If somebody gives me a character that's fun to play, whether it's funny, serious, scary, it doesn't matter to me. I'm happy to play anything.
I know the answer, but I want to hear it from you. Why do people why do people love Corner Gas?
I don't know the answer. I don't know why people like it. I mean, like I said, I think it's one of those things when we made the first season, you know, we just made it, and you have no idea how something's going to be perceived. And for some reason, it struck a chord with people. I think it, going back to what I was saying, and I know Brent, that the Corner Gas is very much Brent. It's where he grew up. I think he once said too, it's like he always imagined if he didn't get into stand up, he'd probably be working at the gas station in Tisdale, and it's sort of like how he sees his life, small town life. And I think it's the fact that it's just an honest show, not turning out to be anything other than it is. I think people just took to that, you know, and it just kind of grew. It's great.
So you know the answers because you just said it. You can,
I guess so. I don't know.
People can relate to it. You feel good watching it. It's funny. And it's just, like I say, it's just a wonderful product, and it was so great to have the movie. Fred Wanick's here. Played Hank Yarbo on Corner Gas. We'll be back with Corner Gas, the movie. The Kickstarter program, I want to ask you about that a little bit. I've donated to it. Others have donated to it. Were you surprised to see one day and you made your goal, and now it looks like it's going to double very soon?
Oh, I was blown away, to be honest. It's amazing, and I was completely shocked. I couldn't believe it. It was on the front page or whatever of the Kickstarter as one of the most successful things that day and stuff. And I guess it proves to us that people are ready to see the movie, which is good. So it's always nice to go into a project knowing that there's a demand for it and people want to see it.
Well, there's a demand. There was from the final show to till now, and I'm going to end up with the interview, Fred. And again, I really appreciate.
Before you do, that's how I got the part. I had to contribute to the campaign, so it only cost me $5,000, which is great. I think it's a smoking deal.
So you get that part to come on the couple of lines, the walk on roll. Good for you. But listen, I want to end up thanking you, first of all, for coming on the show. Hopefully we can talk again as production is going on. We love you here in Saskatchewan. I'm in Weyburn, yet the program goes across the world and on all cable systems and everything. But Saskatchewan and Fred Wanick, Corner Gas, I want to give you the final word on your final thoughts on being able to come back here.
Well, we talked when we first started talking. You know, you were talking about is it great to see the casting and stuff? And it is. And one of the major reasons I'm excited to come back is, you know, we spent 6 years in Saskatchewan and Regina and in Rollo, and Regina especially really became a second home. And I'm it's been too long. It's been too long since I've been there, and I'm really excited to get back and see some friends and go to O'Hanlon's for a pizza and a pint. It's going to be a lot of memories reminded there. I'm very excited.
Yeah, it sounds fantastic. Listen, all the luck with the best of luck with the production, the movie, and I may be in contact to have you come on again if you'd so choose.
I would love to. That'd be great. Anytime. We're there till the end of July, so I better hear from you.
Thanks, Fred. Take care, my friend.
Okay, you too. All the best.
Okay, bye-bye. That's actor Fred Wanick, played Hank Yarbo on Corner Gas for a number of years, and he's been in the business a long time, American movies, Monk on USA Network. He's been acting for a long time, and it's great to see him coming back to Saskatchewan and the whole Corner Gas gang. I'm going to take a break, and we'll be back here on the Dana Presser Show on Scared Monkeys Radio with Alexander Hortis, the author of the new book, The Mob in the City, The Hidden History of How the Mafia Captured New York. It's a fantastic book, and the author will be here to talk about it in just a minute. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. This is the Dana Presser Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. I always love to have an author of a new book on the program, and I love to sit back and look at the history of the mafia. And my next guest, Alex Hortis, is the author of the new book, The Mob in the City, The Hidden History of How the Mafia Captured New York. Welcome, sir. Nice to have you on the program.
Thanks for having me on.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, and then we'll get into the book.
Sure. I, like a lot of people, was fascinated by the mafia growing up, by all the films and movies. And when I went to law school, I had the opportunity to work for Jim Jacobs, who's one of the leading experts in the U.S. on the mafia. And so he sort of opened up this whole new world to me that I barely knew existed. I'm actually from Minnesota, where there is no mafia. And it was an entire new world for me. I had no idea that waste hauling could be connected to organized crime. And so I had sort of had this in the back of my mind to write a book like this for a while. I'm an attorney, so I was a practicing attorney for a decade before I decided to return and write this book. And so I decided to do it. It sort of been percolating in the back of my mind for a while. And so I wrote the book. I currently live in Baltimore, Maryland. I lived in New York for a long time. And I'm very excited the book just came out.
It's always interesting, like you say, the public's fascination with the mafia, mine included. You hear the stories. Some of it's glamorized, some of it isn't. Obviously, it's the mafia. There's a lot of violence, death, murder, you name it. The Gaudis most recently, and we don't hear about it as much as we used to. Rudy Giuliani and his, and even JF Kennedy Jr., everyone in New York wanted to take on the mafia. But what made you pick this era from the 30s to the 50s, which I think is the right era to talk about?
Well, for me, this is the most interesting era. And why it is because it's when they essentially took power. There was, you know, nascent mafia as far back as at least the 1890s. Probably earlier. And as you said, they continue to be very significant later on until well into the 80s and early 90s. But the question about when they actually rose to power and how they actually rose to power really hasn't been looked at closely. There's a lot of sort of generalized myths. There's a lot of sort of stories that get percolated, whether they're accurate or not. And so I wanted to go back to the formative era. How did a bunch of street thugs and gangsters take a hold of so many important sectors of America's biggest and most significant city?
You know,
go ahead.
We hear it glamorized lots, the old Untouchable series that I'm old enough to remember and watch, sadly, and it was all about Chicago, but that big operation going on in New York, and the talk of the families and the Sicilian connection. Let's talk about that a little bit and how you deal with that in your book.
Sure. Yeah, Chicago got a lot of the early attention, but in terms of just sort of sheer size and economics, New York was always where it was really at. And it's a complicated history because it's very much an American creation. We often think of it as somehow being transplanted from Sicily, but it would not have taken hold in the way that it did if it didn't have a city that it could plunder. And New York City was sort of perfectly built for the mob. It was sort of the quintessential place for racketeering for a whole variety of reasons. And one of my main sort of themes in the book is that essentially the mafia got really lucky. They had terrific timing. You know, they did have, you know, a great degree of sophistication and savvy, but they had a city to plunder like no other in the world, including in Sicily. While the mafia is very powerful in Sicily, even to this day, it never quite achieved the economic sort of prominence that it did in New York City.
One of the strange things, author Alex Hortis is here talking about his new book, The Mob in the City, is the mafia's and the Cosa Nostra's involvement in gay bars in the 1930s. Just share a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's got a lot of surprise. And it was a surprise to me before I looked into it. You know, it's part, again, of the theme of how the mafia really sort of played on social forces in New York. And so let's just go back in time. What happened was, after Prohibition is repealed in the United States, the lawmakers were sort of worried about having a return to the saloon days. So while they legalized the bars in New York, they also heavily regulated them. There was also a lot of animosity towards homosexuals starting roughly in the 1930s. Before that, believe it or not, it actually was fairly tolerant, relatively tolerant in New York City. But what happened was it was the imposition of the closet. And so the New York State Liquor Authority starts closing down all these gay bars. So Vito Genovese, who came up in Greenwich Village, which was sort of a center for homosexuals, sees all these bars closing down. And he says, I know how to deal with the cops. I'm good at this. I deal with them on a whole host of other things. And so I know how to stand up to the cops and to stop them from shutting down these gay bars. And I can make a lot of money off of it because there's not going to be many choices, and I can have a monopoly on it. So as a result, the only group that has the sort of the clout and the cash to systematically stand up to the police during this very anti-gay era is organized crime. And in specifically in Greenwich Village, it's the Vito Genovese and his crews. And so as a result, from the 1930s until well into the 70s, and some places beyond that, you know, a huge chunk of the gay bars in New York City, and I should add in some other cities as well, were controlled by Cosa Nostra. So while it wouldn't necessarily come to mind starting off, it kind of makes sense. What does the mafia do? They specialize in illegal markets. In New York City, gay life was essentially illegal. And so they're the ones who can stand up to it, they can make a lot of money off of it, and they do for a very long time.
You mentioned economics, the money-making. Again, we see it glorified in the movies and on TV. But just how important was the dollar to how the families operated?
Oh, I think that's often overlooked. I mean, these were essentially money-making enterprises. You know, for all the mythology and talk of, you know, great honor and loyalty, you know, at the bottom line was the bottom line, and that they were in business to make money. And so they didn't have a lot of scruples about it. So wherever there was an illegal market in New York City, there's a pretty good chance the mafia was heavily involved with it, because they were, at the time, the strongest and most sophisticated crime syndicates in New York. So you go from everything from narcotics to, like you mentioned, gay bars to gambling on professional boxing to you know, a lot of sort of illegal sub you know, black market, like you know, some loan sharking, some gambling, and then also, unfortunately, a lot of labor racketeering as well. The mafia was there, so they had all these income streams coming in at once. It was enough to support over 2,000 active made men and 5 full families, not to mention thousands of criminal associates. So you had gangsters that were essentially living for generations in some cases off of New York City, and all they were doing all day long was making money off of illegal rackets and illegal crimes. That's pretty phenomenal. There's not a whole lot of places of multi-generational crime syndicates like on the level of the New York Mafia.
Alex Ortis is here talking about his new book, The Mob in the City. How difficult is it to go back and research something like this? I'm sure there's freedom of information requests that you make. And how long did it take?
That's a great question. You know, it's a challenge because there's no such thing as, you know, like the Gambino family archive. And they don't give a lot of interviews. And when they do, you know, how much can you believe anyway?
Sure.
So there's not, you know, but the sources are there. You have to look for them. You have to look in unusual places in some cases. The good news is that they were being tracked by some law enforcement at a relatively early stages. Because we can find out through trial records and court records. Now, a lot of times we don't know the significance of it unless you know who the people are involved. For example, I'll give you the gay bar example is a very good example. People would not have really thought to look at the mafia running gay bars. But if you see the complaints that are filed in, like, Billboard magazine and shutdowns of some gay bars, you can figure out the names of the owners. And then if you know the names of the owners that are connected to the mafia, you can figure out who actually was owning these bars. It took me off and on, I'd say, at least 3.5 years, because a lot of it was interrupted. I was also working during this time. But I had also been percolating for over a decade, because ever since I had worked in law school about it, I had an idea in mind of where to look and where the sources to look. Another great example, in 1930s, there was a Federal Bureau of Narcotics agent. The Federal Bureau of Narcotics was actually far ahead of the FBI in terms of tracking the mafia. And there are a lot of reasons for that, but one of the reasons is that the mafia you know, contrary to the mythology, was very heavily involved in narcotics and heroin trafficking since the mid-1930s. And so the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, there's individuals who had, like, these work diaries. And so they would take day-by-day sort of journals of what was going on, who they were tracking, who they were following. And they're stored in one place at Notre Dame University in Indiana. So I went there. And it's phenomenal that he's talking about all these mafiosi like Joe Valachi, and all these famous people, in fact, and it just as matter of factly, and so it opened up a whole new world. So it takes it's very challenging. It's not a typical history project by any means, but the sources are there if you're willing to look hard for them.
What about the nightlife? What about entertainers? We've all heard Frank Sinatra, the Rat Pack, and the association with the mob. Is that mythology, or was there a lot of connection between entertainment and the families?
That is one area where it was not mythology at all, because they had extensive connections. And look, I'm not one to sit back and blame or judge a lot of these entertainers. They didn't have a choice. I mean, most of the great jazz clubs were owned by former bootleggers, because when you think about it, during Prohibition, all the nightlife, including music, including entertainment, gets pushed into the illegal speakeasies. And so when repeal comes, who do you think owns the new bars? It's going to be a lot of the old gangsters and speakeasy operators. And so there's a lot of sort of difficult, challenging stories. Like Louis Armstrong, it was really quite sad, this immense talent, but he had to sort of dodge gangsters for the early part of his career, in some cases literally running from them, and then until he finally gets Joe Glasser, who used to work for Al Capone, to become his manager. And then he said that Glasser saved me from the gangsters. the Copacabana, the famous Copacabana, is secretly owned by Frank Costello, the acting boss of the Luciano family. Frank Sinatra, look, my dad's a huge Frank Sinatra fan. I know some people don't want to hear this, but the fact of the matter is, it's pretty well documented at this point that he had ties to mobsters going all the way back to his earliest days. And, he had to. He was coming up in all these nightclubs. So he's actually a quite good friend of Willie Moretti. Willie Moretti is a vicious enforcer for Frank Costello. The story that you often, sort of portrayed in The Godfather, in which the Johnny Fontaine character is told that he gets out of a contract because somebody told him they're making an offer he can't refuse.
That's right.
That's actually based on a true story. Tommy Dorsey had Frank Sinatra under contract, and he later gave an interview to American Mercury in which he said that a couple of thugs essentially came to him and said, "You better sign this release or you're not leaving this office." And so, Sinatra in his lifetime always sort of denied it, said he was being smeared. But the truth of the matter is, it's very much his fault, too. He was hanging out with these guys. He liked these guys. He was sort of this skinny kid from Hoboken, and he kind of wanted to play the tough guy throughout his whole life. Like, his daughter later wrote about this, what he was so fascinated about the gangsters is they were so different from him. They were not like him. And so that's why he was so attracted to it. And so it's actually really not a smear when it comes to Frank Sinatra. He really was heavily involved, he hung around with a lot of these guys, socialized with them, in some cases invested money with them, invited them, to his clubs, and he loved them. He loved having them around.
The fascination with mafia and what we see again on television and the movies and what we research a little bit, and law enforcement. You've got one side, the iron-jawed type Elliot Ness, take no hostages, I'm going to go and kick some butt, to seeing the cop on the beat that's on the take from the mafia. Again, what's mythology? What's the truth?
It's something. The mafia is sort of America's Rorschach test. People read into it whatever they want to read into it at different eras. So when you look at the early gangster films, you know, like Little Caesar, Scarface, you know, which are made during the Great Depression, those themes are about, you know, sort of the poor man fighting to make himself against the odds. Okay, then you see later on the Godfather films in the 70s. And what are those about? Well, they're sort of about immigration, family, but also corruption of American institutions. And so later on, you know, you have like The Sopranos, and what's that about? It's about suburban angst, mortality. You know, the mafia is involved, obviously, is the main theme of all of these, but they're real, people are projecting what they want to project onto them. And I would urge, in order to separate the myth from the facts, is to look at them as something that people often don't look at them, as a crime syndicate that arose within a very specific context in New York City. If instead of looking at them as sort of grand fables or some, you know, special band of brothers that were special good fellows of criminals, let's look at them, you know, as we look at it, as other crime syndicates. So a perfect example is narcotics, and this would be a great way to differentiate between the two of them. Now, if you remember, the entire plot of The Godfather was Don Corleone doesn't want to go into the drug business. All the other younger, less traditional gangsters want to go into the mob business, but he's the real mafioso, right? And so he stands up to them. And there's a famous, you know, meeting where they're planning out the entire heroin trade around a table. Well, this is all bunk. the mafia was heavily involved in narcotics starting from the 1930s onward. Lucky Luciano, people often forget, was arrested and spent time for dealing narcotics
right.
as far back as 1917. They were heavily involved in it. From the very beginning, and they've sort of gotten a pass in a lot of ways on that for decades. They were flooding the streets of New York City with heroin during, you know, the heroin epidemic after World War II. And the way that you can sort of figure this out, there's these great interviews of heroin addicts that were done in New York City. These are old heroin addicts and dealers that were in a methadone clinic. And so when you ask them, and this was done in 1980, and I don't know if they ever saw The Godfather, I don't know, you know, if they ever saw films or not, but when you ask them, you know, when do you remember the changeover, you know, who was running the drug trade? They say, well, at first it was Chinese and Jewish gangsters,
right.
But then in 1930s, it's the Italians in East Harlem. So the Italians, so instead of, you know, being freighted with all this mythology about how, oh, you know, Don Corleone did not deal drugs and how, you know, they were more honorable than that, you just had people who actually lived through it history, and they just say matter-of-factly, oh, yeah, it was the Sicilians in East Harlem. The Sicilians in East Harlem was the mafia, essentially, in this era, because they dominated heroin trafficking. And so, you know, that's a perfect example of something you can separate the myth from the fact just by going back to primary sources. Go back to the people who actually knew. Go back to the sources and the documents. And, you know, disabuse yourself of a minute of all this mythology. And so that was like a key source that I found out. And then when they started to describe it, it made a lot of sense with the other documentary records that I found.
Alex Hortis is here talking about his book, The Mob in the City, The Hidden History of How the Mafia Captured New York. A little bit off topic, but still around the same genre. Joe Kennedy, John F. Kennedy, the election, the unions, getting the mafia to help get him elected. What about governments and the mafia?
It's a great question, and we've moved on to perhaps the most controversial aspect of this. From what I have seen, I don't see much credible evidence that the Kennedys were ever heavily involved with the mafia, and I certainly don't think that there's credible evidence that somehow they swung the election for John Kennedy. Now, there's been a lot of theories, and oftentimes what people do is they'll take, you know, some sort of strange facts, and they'll build on that, and they'll build inference upon inference on that, and build, you know, construct sort of a huge conspiracy. You know, my friend John Binder, who was a finance professor at Chicago, he actually went back and he looked at the Chicago returns. He didn't see any significant And he's, you know, he's sort of a quantitative expert on this, and he didn't see any trend, any significant changes from prior elections that could be attributed to the Chicago outfit. Most of the time what you have where these stories come up are when people are writing sort of tell-all books and they want to sell more books,
exactly.
So they construct these elaborate theories. Now, you know, conversely, on the local side, absolutely, the mafia was entrenched in the power structure of New York City. They were very heavily involved with many of the unions, not all, but many of the significant unions, the Longshoremen's Union, you know, some parts of the garment sector union, certainly the Teamsters, you know, on a local level, and that gave them political clout because they bring votes and they have a lot of members. And so you have a case of Frank Costello where he is essentially picking judges in New York City. So you have a mafia boss essentially picking judges in New York City. And so when you look at the records there of these mafiosos, they often, you know, in the 50s, 40s, 50s, they often have many, many, many charges, but very, very, very few convictions, and almost no prison time. And we don't know how many of these cases were fixed, but it was an awful lot of them. There later was a study that was done in the 1960s, and they showed that known mobsters, mafioso, had an infinitely small chance of actually going to prison compared to even other, you know, sophisticated, you know, more sophisticated criminals. They were just so entrenched in New York City. The NYPD as well was just, in many cases, was an appendage to the mafia, unfortunately. And I don't say that lightly, but the evidence is just sort of overwhelming. So, to answer your question, on the federal level, we don't see a lot of it. I don't personally buy a lot of the Kennedy stories, and I'm not alone in that. There's other people who have come along and debunked it as well, but I'm among that smaller crowd that doesn't buy it. But on the local level, absolutely. The mafia essentially owned a lot of the local agencies and the police in New York City for most of the 20th century.
Listen, our time is up. The book, The Mob in the City, The Hidden History of How the Mafia Captured New York, author Alex Hortis has been here. Click on the link on the show notes on how to pick up the book. It's a fantastic read. We're all fascinated with the mafia. Listen, thank you, sir. I appreciate you coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Take care.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Yeah, it's the mob, it's the mafia, it's the wise guys, the Sopranos. Learn about the history. Some of it's bunk, some of it's true. And this is an excellent book from Prometheus Books to pick up. And again, click on the link on the show notes. We're going to take a quick break, and I'll come back with some final thoughts on the most recent mass shooting in California. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. Okay, we're back. The most recent mass shooting in California, again, raises the ugly era, the ugly head of gun ownership. The gun proponents are out there. The gun opponents are out there. If they had a gun, if he didn't have a gun, how can he get a gun? Somebody with psychiatric issues like this. What we're forgetting is the first few victims were killed by being stabbed, macheted, hatchet, whatever it was. We can go back to many mass shootings across the United States, across North America, across the world. Mass killings. Is it all with a gun? Is it all about guns? Maybe, maybe not. But something that's not talked about. All of the lawyers, the former DAs, the defense lawyers, the pundits, the cops, the ex-cops, everyone that's on TV talking about this, the psychologists, psychiatrists, they're all saying this and they're all saying that, but I'm saying this, the system, the mental health system. Is there something wrong with somebody being able to go on YouTube and post the garbage that he was posting? Is YouTube being monitored? Should the internet be free? Should someone at YouTube that's monitoring what's going on there, the content, be able to come forward to law enforcement and say, listen, you've got a problem here? Should law enforcement take these types of situations more seriously? What about the family? The family of the shooter are victims too. All the victims that are out there, I've heard families that have come forward and forgave the shooter. The mental health system is huge in this. What about that? What about the treatment that is being given? Is there enough out there to protect you and I and others from individuals like this? How do we know what's going to happen? What about the plans? What about the next one? There will be a next one. It's not all about guns, ladies and gentlemen. It's part of it, but there is a much bigger picture. Anyway, I want to thank my guest tonight, Fred Hwanek from Corner Gas, and all the shows that he's been in, Down for Mayor, CornerGasTheMovie.com. Check it out. Look at the Kickstarter program that's on there. It's going to be a lot of fun. It's a great show. You sit back and you laugh when you watch it, and it makes you feel good. And, of course, The Mob in the City, the new book by Alex Hortis. You want to learn about gangsters, that's the book to get. My name's Andrew Pretzer. I hope you enjoyed tonight's show, and we'll see you again real soon here on Scared Monkeys Radio.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at ScaredMonkeysRadio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of ScaredMonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.